Before we get started with today's show, be sure to check out ESPN Daily, our podcast that's putting out an episode every single day, rain or shine. It's a great episode this week with Ricky Williams talking about the role that cannabis played in his career in the NFL and the problems that came with it for him. Subscribe to ESPN Daily in the right time wherever you get your podcast. Also, we're going to be discussing Michael Jordan and the Bulls' first championship at the Right Time Book Club, but remember to tune in to The Last Dance. The series continues this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. As Jordan's fame soared to unparalleled levels in the early 90s with consecutive NBA titles and a starring role on the Dream Team, his image as Air Jordan made him a cultural icon. Yet with extraordinary fame came extraordinary scrutiny, and in 1993, it all came to a head with the Bulls' pursuit of a third straight title shadowed by questions about Jordan's gambling. Episodes 5 and 6 of The Last Dance premiere Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. Don't have access to ESPN? Go to ESPNInstantAccess.com to sign up today or listen to the wrap-up podcast hosted by Jalen and Jacoby immediately following the broadcast. Our coverage of The Last Dance is brought to you by State Farm. When you want the real deal, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Coverage is also brought to you by AT&T. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, it's episode 2 of The Right Time Book Club. Benny Goodwill of Yahoo Sports will be on with us to talk about the Jordan Rules by Sam Smith. But first, oh, happy day, guys. Happy, happy, happy day. The NCAA has said that it will allow athletes to make money off of their name, image, and likeness. Kinda. Guys, kinda. Like, I see this pop up. I hear what Mark Emmert is talking about. And all I sense, when in one way or another, I have a sensory response to these things is, man, this ain't nothing. This ain't it. Right? And I get it. A whole lot of people have worked really, really hard to get to a point where the NCAA would even do this, right? Where the NCAA would even go so far as to say, we want to come up with a plan so that starting in January of 2021, athletes will have a certain measure of economic freedom that they have not had before, right? Okay, cool. They want to go ahead and do this. They say they want to figure out a way to make it happen. That's fine. Here's my issue with it, okay? Gabe, you let me know if I'm tripping here. Every single thing that I have seen about the name, image, and likeness, at least from the NCAA, I've seen them more concerned with how to cap the amount of money that players can receive than I have seen them say that they want to do things to help players, because the big thing that they want to make sure of at every turn is that the compensation that the players receive is actually in line with market value for their skills. So what they don't want is for a player to be like, hey, I got this deal with this booster, right? This booster, he runs this feed shop. He sells feed and he wants me to do a commercial for them. And they gonna pay me $300,000 for it. You see what I mean? Right? That's what they say. They want to prevent that, and they want to prevent that for reasons that I understand. But their argument is that they want to make sure that what the players receive is market value. But this is the NCAA. What has the NCAA told us for decades was the players' market value? Zero. Right? At every turn, the NCAA has told us that the player's market value is zero. And so if they want to put themselves in a position where they're going to be evaluating every name, image, and likeness deal that a player receives, and that's what they want to do, which I understand because they are a bit of a clearinghouse, right? Like, I get that in theory. But if what they want to do is evaluate every deal to make sure that the player is receiving market value, what is market value in the eyes and the minds of the NCAA after decades of telling us that these guys weren't worth anything? Like, how do you think this is actually going to work? Do you think this is actually going to have some measure of functional value as long as this collection of screw-ups is going to be the people that's in charge of it? As I've said, the NCAA, all they good at is running tournaments and keeping people broke, right? Like, that is what they have focused their talents on through all this time. I have no reason to believe that they have any idea whatsoever what to do to make this work. I do not see it. I really, really don't. I don't think that the schools are going to be working on behalf of the players to try to assist them, because they're operating on the Pretty Tony principle. I keep some broke. They wake up with some money, they subject to go crazy. You got cats like Dabo Swinney, for example, right? Dabo has made it clear. They start paying players. He said that's the day he going to quit and everything else. You think Dabo going to be out here trying to help these boys get money? You think that if these boosters around the school come to Clemson and be like, hey, man, we want to find a way to help endure, you know, get these guys some name, image, and likeness stuff or whatever. You think that Dabo's going to be like, yo, what's the best thing I could do to help you out? Right? Maybe he will, just because of the recruiting ramifications of it. But based on everything you've heard, these schools are not on the side of helping these players get this money. These schools have demonstrated they have an ideology that's in line with stopping them from getting money, because they think stopping them from getting money is ultimately what's going to help them. That's why Emmert is out here like, yo, Congress, help us. All these states and all these laws, there's no way we can deal with all of that. We need the federal government to come guide us. We need the federal government to come give us an answer as to how we're going to do this. And we're probably going to need a little bit of an antitrust exemption to really make all of this stuff happen. So to me, it is fantastic to a degree that the NCAA is trying this. But I want to give you an example that tells you, like, kind of, I don't want to say the whole thing is a con, but a con-like element to this. So, Gabe, are you familiar with the name Donna Shalala?
University of Miami's Donna Shalala.
Yes. She was former secretary, I want to say, of Health and Human Services in the Clinton administration. Like, that was her big job, was that one there. And I want to say before that, she was a professor at the University of Wisconsin or whatever. But she is an academic who then wound up getting into politics and then wound up getting the job as the president of the University of Miami. And she was the president during the whole Nevin Shapiro situation, right? And now she is in the House of Representatives. And I found this fascinating, that I saw a quote from her about what Emmert came in talking about. And her response to that was, wait a minute. So we were trying to get the agents and the boosters out, and now you're telling me that we're letting the agents and the boosters in? Right? Because think about this for a second. At least from what I can tell here, Shalala is not a person who, like, grew up of this world, right? Like, watching all these games, like, really caring about it. So now she becomes the president of the school that's got this football program, right? And they're telling her, hey, we got to go, you know, you got to meet these boosters. These boosters give this money, whatever it is, da, da, da. And she did that. And Shapiro, who's just another dude that she met at a party in all likelihood, right? So they got pictures of her with him and everything. And then Shapiro comes and tells, and they tell her, hey, we got to get these guys out of here. She's like, yeah, you're right. NCAA, that's the game, right? Like, all the rhetoric, it sounds like she bought, because she ain't of it, right? And so she believed everything they said. You're damn right. Let's go ahead and do this, and let's get these boosters out of here. And now she's in Congress, and all the hell that she went through at Miami around Shapiro and them going on probation and everything else, everything that she had to, all the muck that she had to wade through to deal with that, and now she's sitting there in Congress, and this dude comes up, the same set of people, the same organization that was telling her about how they had to run these people out, are now telling her, we need help to let these people in? Can you imagine how blown her mind was by that idea? Like, that's how ridiculous all of this is. NCAA swore up and down for all this time that the whole thing would collapse if the boys ever got any money. And now they're looking around and realizing they in a place where they got to fight for survival and they got to make a concession. And it's basically, forget we ever said all of that stuff. But at the same time, trying to figure out how to make sure that nobody actually gets too much money. They call it in the name of competitive balance, as if competitive balance exists. Right? As if that's a thing. Because look, as things stand presently, and I just don't think enough is quite made out of this. You've always had your perennial powers, but they're ups, they're downs. You know, there's all that stuff, right? Who are the current, in football in particular, who are the current perennial powers? There's really three, right? Alabama, Clemson, and Ohio State. I feel like those right now are three programs that are operating at a level above everybody else. Like Oklahoma is a half step below them, but those are the three that are on top. Dog, Alabama been good for 12 straight years. 12, like really good for 12 straight years. Ohio State has basically been good, like really good, for 20 straight years. From 2002 until now, they have been really good. The only year in that stretch, I feel like, where Ohio State wasn't really good is maybe two. It was like 2003 and the year that Tressel, it all blew up, right? But that's 20 years of being really good. Clemson's at a point now where, like, this run for Clemson for real starts, like, Deshaun Watson showing up in, like, 2014. But Clemson made the Orange Bowl in 2010. Like, they won the ACC in 2010. I can't think of a time that the folks that's been running it have run it like that, where we have so many schools that are on rolls that are like this one, right? LSU might be ready to go on another one of those runs. You ain't got no balance out here. Like, you don't. You know, like, what's Alabama, what's, how much more entrenched on top can Alabama get if they get to come out here and give people deals? Like, if we being square about it, like, how much more can they possibly get? No, man, it's all ridiculous. It all falls apart. There's no logic that supports it, but they're all still so concerned with, we got to make sure that these deals are legitimate. Y'all about to go out of business. Y'all got programs left and right that are worried right now about going out of business. And you out here trying to make sure that these cats don't get no money? Come on now. I want to give you something else to think about here. Two things. And these are really my problems with the discourse that surrounds this more than what's going on. Problem one. I saw a whole lot of people who were tweeting about making the point that, like, Ohio State, the Tressel situation with the tattoos, you know, and everything that went on with that. That basically, folks noted the irony that Gene Smith, the athletic director at Ohio State, and they had to run Tressel out behind all this stuff that now would be allowed. And Gene Smith is up there at all these press conferences, right? And they're like, wow, that was such a big scandal. Now it means nothing. Guys, it never had to mean anything in the first place. Like, the last thing I want to hear from is media members who make the argument like, oh, damn, now this stuff isn't even a scandal. It was before. We made it a scandal. We didn't have to act like that stuff was a big deal. Hey, man, I just saw somebody show up with a tattoo on his arm of a far right-wing militia, and it never turned into a big deal. You know why? Because the media decided they didn't want it to be no big damn deal. We decide what is it is not a big deal. Y'all decided to make that thing with Terrell Pryor a big deal. You did not have to do that. That was your call. The NCAA has changed the rules on this. Okay, but we always had the power to say that this was ridiculous. And a whole lot of y'all did not. And y'all ain't going to keep saying, if it's now allowed, all of a sudden you're going to ride with it. And at some point, you got to stand on some measure of principle, because you had the chance back then. And some of us did, by the way. You had the chance back then to be like, yo, this is silly. Instead, you just rode along with it, right? So they're like, don't pop up to me and be like, wow, it's really funny. All that stuff I used to care about doesn't matter anymore. Why'd you care, right? That's number one. Number two. And this is maybe the biggest thing to me. The NCAA keeps trying to do this without paying any of their own money. This is why they don't get any credit for this. In fact, this just spells out how craven the whole operation is. They're like, yeah, you guys can go get yourself a little bit of money. We still gonna get all the money. We still gonna get lots of money. Y'all can go get a little money. We still getting a lot of it, and we ain't giving you a damn bit of it. And that's the part that infuriates me more than anything else. So Jay Billis has always been at the front of this issue for a whole lot of people, right? Like, when people think about the idea of paying athletes, they think about Jay Billis. I've always had a huge fundamental disagreement with Billis on this. And I actually think this fundamental disagreement is a big part of why Billis is at front of this. Billis, as far as I can tell, and if I got this wrong, somebody let me know. If he's had some change in this, you let me know. But Billis's argument has always been what he would call an Olympic model, which is basically allow the athletes to go get their own sponsorships and everything else. But Billis, as far as I can tell, has never been about the schools cutting a check. And that, to me, is a perpetuation of the status quo. Like, what the NCAA is talking about right now is a perpetuation of the status quo. It perpetuates them having an inordinate level of control on these matters. And it, again, they don't have to pay anybody any money. They can keep paying themselves. They can keep paying their friends. They can keep paying for stadium additions and all of this stuff, but they will not pay the players. And that's where this loses me. The big money in this is television. The players still don't get a cut of the television money, right? The coach is out here with a $1 million apparel deal. They still don't get anything, even though they're the ones that are actually wearing the apparel that they want people to buy and that they want people to order. Dabo Swinney got a Nike deal so he could sell like them hoodies and them sweater vests and stuff like that, right? You think that's what it is? No, it's for the stuff that the boys wear out there. They still can't get any of that money. Sonny Vaccaro has always made the point. He's not like the name and image and likeness stuff is cool, but he's like the players should receive a percentage of revenues because that's the reason why we're here. We would not be here having this discussion about whether these guys should get paid if there weren't so much money in it for everybody else. Since there is that money in it for everybody else, now we come to the table. And so the schools are still saying, our stack, leave our stack alone. We're going to find a way for you to get a little money outside of here, but leave our stack alone. To which I say, forget about name, image, and likeness, man. Just let the boosters throw money around. Like if your thing is that you just don't want to pay them out of your stack, then let somebody else pay them out of their stack. You don't have to operate in this way to do it, right? So nobody in the end, as this goes, is still talking about doing anything that I believe to legitimately be right by the players. Here's where I think it becomes important, and you got to remember this. Where we get into is, so Gabe, are you like familiar with the concept of the deserving and undeserving poor?
To a certain degree.
The idea that basically some people are poor because they work hard and things went wrong. Some people are poor because they did it to themselves, right? And we have just different ways that we treat people and their poverty as we try to figure out that a certain measure of poverty is going to come with capitalism. How much of this is just kind of like institutional and how much of this is because there is something wrong with you? And by the same idea that we determine who are the deserving and undeserving poor, we also decide who are the deserving and undeserving rich. We decide who it is that deserves to get a certain measure of money. And what the name, image, and likeness stuff is in effect saying is that the people who deserve to get paid are the famous players, right? They are the ones who are entitled to money because otherwise, like honestly, on a football team, 85 scholarship players, how many of those guys actually able to get some money on the name of their likeness? Not that many, right? Like it's going to be the high end of the roster that's able to do it. The low end of the roster is still out here taking these concussions. The low end of the roster is still out here tearing their ACLs. The low end of the roster is still out here playing on scout team offense, facing up against all these future NFL players on defense, getting the knocked out of them every time that they get the ball so those guys can be better. And ain't nobody in the world about to give those dudes no commercial or no Instagram sponsored influencer type stuff for getting the hell beat out of them by the guys that are going to be future professionals. They're not going to get a dime for any of this. They're still going to wind up getting exploited because somehow you have decided because they low on the totem, they don't deserve to get this money. And why won't they get any of this money? Because the NCAA refuses to pay any money out of their stack. And all the people that say, let the guys go make money off their name, image, and likeness, hardly any of you are going to stand up and say the institutions should pay them directly. The people that owe the players money are not local businesses who themselves are looking to profit off of them. No, the people who owe them money are the people who make all the money off of this. And if all you're going to get out of this is that the people who make the most money off of this still don't have to give anybody anything, then I don't give a damn what they do.
And that's what differentiates it up still from the G League model, right? Because the G League is actually they're paying the athletes and then the athletes are allowed to go and pursue endorsement deals yeah. and field agents and all that sort of stuff. The straw on the camel's back here within the last week is those three recruits.
Yes.
Finally saying enough is enough. I'm right. going to go get paid.
But see, here's the part that makes this most exploitative by the colleges that isn't discussed enough. The NCAA and its member institutions do a lot of good things for people. I don't want to get to the place where that gets ignored, right? Like you go talk to the people that work in support staffs, you know, and all of that stuff. there's a lot of great stories and a lot of kids whose lives are absolutely made better by the fact that they have gone into these environments, right? It's important to stress that. And the reason why, especially in the face of this thing with these G League guys, being a grown up at 18 is not what's up. Like, nobody that's ever been a grown up at 18 is wound up thinking that was a great idea, right? It's not what's up. There's no better incubator to get you toward adulthood than going to college, right? Like, it's a great thing to help you develop at a great time in life and a place that's built to help people do that sort of thing. It is best, I think, for everybody in these environments to go spend some time in a collegiate environment. I really do believe that it's best for them. I think that for their future development and all of that stuff, it's best. And that's kind of what they lean on, right? Is their knowledge that they do actually have something to provide. Because to me, the idea of sending my kid off to go be in the G League traveling all-stars at 18 years old, like, we can't pass up that money. We can't walk away from that bread. But it's fair to ask if, like, socially and all that stuff, they'd be better off with a year or two of college. Michael Beasley did 1 year of college. Oh boy, I bet he wishes he'd done two or three, right? Like, there are people that need that time, that need to grow up. 18 is not the time to be grown. It's not there. And so, like, that's always been my argument against going to the G League, against going to Europe, all of those things. I just don't think that's the way to do it, right? But that's what makes the exploitation of college even worse. It's because they know they should be paying those guys. But they're like, nope. But just let us come take care of you. That'll be all right. They don't, like, actually care about you. They just know that this is probably a better move for you. And then they won't do what's fair. And so, yeah, to me, it's just as simple as this. Nice. Wait, way to go. Way to tell these guys they can go get their own money. Come off your money. And until they come off their money, this fight can't stop. All right. It is the right time, book club. This year, we are reading The Jordan Rules by Sam Smith. Catching up late, you got time. It's a podcast. You can listen when you can. Last week, we had J.A. Adande to join us for the first installment. And this week, from Yahoo Sports, comes the NBA. My man, Vinny Goodwill, is on. And I want to start this by telling everybody, as we get into this, that Vinny's from Detroit. It is an important thing to note that Vinny is from Detroit. Not because you are biased, but because you are informed in a way that the mainstream is not necessarily, for the Pistons are the enemy in this story for people from every place but Detroit.
I was trying to figure out where you were going to go with that. At first, I thought you were going to talk about the fro. But since you said the Detroit thing, I'm like, okay, do I need to get defensive right now? Or
you were getting ready. Shed some light on things from an angle that people may not have had. Because it's funny, as much as Mike killed the Knicks, New York does not hate Michael Jordan, right? As much as he killed the Cavs, Cleveland does not hate Michael Jordan. Detroit, there's a little beef.
Just a little bit. And the only reason there's a beef, Bo, is because of this one reason. Give a team their props.
Yep.
You ain't got to give them flowers or nothing like that. You just got to own what they did. Oh, don't say, oh, we kicked his ass. No. They beat us. How about he just say that? They beat us. They were better. I had to go against some monsters. If you say, hey, look, I went against the best three guard rotation in the history of the game, and I had to defend one of those guys while the other two were going off, you look even better, Michael Jordan. But no, you want to say, oh, they didn't deserve their championships because they beat me. That's the one team Michael Jordan has to give props to. That's the one team he refuses to give props to.
I do think people struggle with the idea that those Pistons teams were great. Right. And I think part of what gets lost about those Pistons teams is, and you let me know if I'm wrong here, can you name another team that won titles with a 9-man rotation?
Not where the 9th man is as important as the 8th.
Right.
You gotta think James Edwards was the 9th man in 1989. And then he became the starting center the next year in 90 when it lost Mahorn to expansion. So he went from the 9th man to the first option on offense in that starting unit. Like, you can't go to prominent examples of that where, you know, okay, you got Isaiah, you got Joe, right? And then your third option, your third best player, maybe Lambeer, maybe probably a younger Rodman at that point. But those guys weren't offensive options. So the team is so uniquely built, it's hard for people to sort of contextualize with how we've been taught. like the way today's games, the way today's teams are built, it's hard for them to really figure that out. Like even like the 04 Pistons weren't really like that.
They really went like 7.
They played 9, but it was like a more so about that first, that starting 5. And then you had a couple of guys off the bench. It really wasn't like this whole 9-man thing. Like if you ask, like name the 7th and 8th man on that 04 Piston team. And well, Bo, you can do it.
Well, I was about to say, Antonio McDyess is one of them,
He
right?
was not there.
Oh, he wasn't?
He was not there.
Jason Maxtill?
Nope. Mehmet Okor. No, Jason Maxtill right. still at Cincinnati.
Right. Mehmet Okor, I remember. And then who else?
SEC country. Beat Duke in the national title game.
Beat Duke in the national title game, but is not Richard Hamilton.
Nope. Beat Grant Hill's Duke team in the national title game.
Oh, okay. So if you beat the Grant Hill team in the national title game, that means you went to, oh, Curtis Williamson.
There you go.
Totally forgot.
There you go.
Right. But with the Pistons, it's funny because those guys, I don't know how many of those guys off the bench were as good as Curtis Williamson, right? But we're talking Mark Aguirre, James Edwards on the first team, John Sally, and
Rodman. And Rodman was a Rodman came off the bench his first year and right. then moved into the starting lineup second championship year. Like the two championship teams are totally different when you look at them. It's the same guys, but the makeup is totally different. Like Aguirre went from starting to coming off the bench. Edwards started in the second year. The only three starters who were really there were Laimbeer, Dumars, and Isaiah.
And they did not have a point guard coming off the bench.
Nope.
And Finis Dembo over there at the end, just like one of the greatest names of all time.
Chuck Nevitt was.
Oh, that's right. 7'5", Chuck Nevitt.
7'5". He was on the 88 team. But yeah, no backup point guard, except if you want to count Vinnie Johnson or Joe Dumars, because they were all pretty much interchangeable at the 1 and 2.
Right. No, it's a lot there. Now, actually, to the Jordan rules now, because I just imagine the Detroit stuff will come up at some point. But to the book itself, one thing I thought was interesting when you were telling me about reading it, as you are someone who has covered NBA teams, let's be honest, you covered a lot of sorry NBA teams,
yes.
right? Right? Because
yes.
you covered the Pistons, but not the bad boy Pistons, just bad Pistons.
Very bad.
Right, right, right. Like, you covered them. Like, actually, I was about to say that, you know, because people had joked that you was like the Black Cat because you covered a team and then nothing good was going to happen. And then I was like, okay, then you went national. But then after you went national, Daryl Morey went and messed up the money and then came to Rona.
So are you accusing me of spreading my Black Cat sort of ishness around the entire league?
I'm saying that if you were back covering the Pistons, they'd have been the only ones to catch the virus. it would be a Detroit only phenomenon. If you were still covering the Pistons, that's what it would be. Daryl Morey would have never said that one thing, right?
Oh, that's right. That's right. Daryl Morey is like the start of this.
Yo, Daryl Morey is like, yo, nobody has to think about me anymore. That's right. Nobody has to think about me. He messed up so much money. Whether you think he was right or wrong or the principle, doesn't matter. The money was messed up.
And the crazy thing is, when all this is done, Bo, nobody's going to think a thing of Daryl Morey. The only reason we're going to think anything about Daryl Morey is if he leaves Houston or right. gets fired, because Fertitta is losing money hand over fist right now.
Yeah, Fertitta is not in a position to be paying nobody not to do a job. That is not going to happen. But it was funny because I would talk to you about what it's like covering a team like that and everything else. And now you read the Jordan rules and you look up and you realize, oh, even the good teams are like this?
I've never seen a team that was so unhappy. Like just reading about a team every day that was so unhappy. Think about it. They were unhappy in every facet of the game. They were unhappy about playing time, which is every team. When you got 12 guys on the team, there's going to be inevitably 4 to 5 guys who are unhappy about their playing time. But to me, the biggest part of it is everybody was semi outwardly concerned about their contracts, right? They were always like, okay, this money's coming in. Who's going to get it? And you got to think, this was before social media and all this other type of stuff, but everybody knew what everybody made. And you could tell it kind of affected. You could tell it affected Scottie Pippen in a way that he started playing at a certain point through that season where they were like, look, he's trying to become more like Michael Jordan. And we always said, Scottie Pippen, you ain't no Michael Jordan. But in that 90-91 season, there were stretches of games where Scottie was like, look, I'm getting mine and I don't care about playing quote unquote team basketball. And statistically, it looked great, but nobody was really happy with it. Phil Jackson wasn't happy with it. Michael Jordan was upset saying, he's never going to let me score 50 this year. You know who that sounds like? Michael Jordan saying, he's never going to let me score 50 this year.
That's like a Kyrie line, right?
Yes. I was thinking of another guy, but Kyrie.
You think about Kobe?
Yes, I was thinking about Kobe.
Yeah, but that's a Kyrie line. Like all these guys, like, man, he tried to hold back my shot, right?
He's trying to suppress my greatness. You're saying that I can't be a scoring champion and win an NBA championship. If these dudes would catch the ball, if Bill Cartwright would catch the ball, we ain't gonna have no problems. Like, think about that, how dominant that team was, right? 61 wins, most in franchise history, and they ran through the playoffs. They lost one game to the 76ers and then once to the Lakers. You would never think a team so dominant would have so many doubts. They had a lot of doubts about themselves, and they were genuinely unhappy. Like, you can start with Horace Grant on that
one. Well, there also only seemed to be like one friendship between guys on the team, right? Like, to me at least, it seemed like Scotty and Horace had a friendship coming in together, but nobody else seemed to have a homeboy on the squad.
Think about it. Nobody had a homeboy on the squad. You know, the shifting big man off the bench was Will Perdue, Stacey King, Scott Williams. Like, they were all in different levels of like uncertainty, like performance uncertainty. So they were all looking at the next guy like, okay, I should be playing. Like, I felt like they respected Bill Cartwright, but maybe just because of the type of personality he was, there didn't seem like a kinship there. There was like a respect for Cartwright. There was certainly a fear for Jordan, and there was an understanding for Pippen. But as far as anything beyond that, like, BJ Armstrong and John Paxson weren't friends, and we wound up seeing how that wound up playing out later between, you know, the two of them. Like, there was this internal competition, external competition, everything else. But there wasn't this great bond. Even Jordan and Pippen, like, the bond that they developed later seemed to come much later. Like, even in that year, remember Michael was saying, headache tonight, Scotty? You know, stuff like, you know, that's Michael Jordan being not unhappy or not even like this bad dude, but that's Michael Jordan being unable to do anything but be Michael Jordan, right?
Right.
Scottie Pippen has a bad game. He's an all-star type of player, but Scottie Pippen has a bad game. The first thing Mike is going to say, headache tonight, Scotty. There's no empathy. He's like looking at Horace Grant, you're too stupid to run plays. And like, think about the causticness.
Right.
That Michael Jordan spoke to his teammates with.
Yo, because on Twitter, Miss Chris Halls made that point. Mike hit him with, you're an idiot. You're too stupid to even remember the plays. We ought to get rid of you. Damn, Mike. Like, for all of Mike's concern that the documentary is going to make him look bad, I'm like, no. The documentary is doing just fine for you. This book, hey, like, he sees it. I don't even find him to be, like, irredeemable in the book. But the book, Mike, oh boy, he bring it to him.
He suffers no fools and he takes no prisoners. He's one of those people, you ever been around somebody, and I could literally be talking about myself here, where whenever somebody gives them an opening, they never hesitate a chance to walk through that door.
Yes.
Whether it's with a sarcastic comment or a well-timed pause or something, you know, something like that, that just says, I'm not going to let anything slide. That's Michael Jordan in 1990-91. And we're talking about a 26, 27-year-old, you know, coming into the prime of his own career at the peak of his innocent celebrity. Not the peak of his celebrity, but at the peak of his innocent celebrity, and just being brutal behind, like, to everybody. Phil Jackson, it took a while for Phil Jackson to warm up on him, but Mike suffered no fools with anybody on that team.
No, man, and it's what I find interesting about Mike is that people want Mike to like them, but he doesn't lean in on the idea that that's what they want. He just kind of exploits it, right? Like, you know, some of this stuff, though, I do like find to be funny. Like, we said, you know, because Craig Hodges, for people who don't know, and I guess this is in the book, Craig Hodges is, like, in a lot of ways, he's a good dude who's done a lot of good work. But he also believed that Ronald Reagan was the devil because his first, middle, and last names all had six letters, right? Like, there's a real conspiracy brother sort of element to Craig Hodges.
We all know one of those.
Yeah. Keep in mind, Craig Hodges had to leave Milwaukee because Craig Hodges turned up on TV with Farrakhan, and Herb Cole was like, oh, no, Siri Bob, who wants him? But this part where Mike said to Hodges, he's like, damn, Hodges, that's one of the Muslim farts. I'm like, I'm sorry, that is ignorant hilarity. Right? Like, that's so ignorant, it's hilarious.
But here's the thing, when you hear that, and this is not politically correct world, this is the locker room world where
Right. Your
filters are down. You know what I'm saying? Your filters ain't on all Madden. Your filters are on all rookie. And when someone says that, like, how do you react? How does someone like John Paxson react when he hears Michael Jordan say something like that? Does he laugh? Because if you laugh too hard, is it one of them, what's so funny, Pax? What you laughing for? It ain't that funny.
Right, right. And as we learned in the book already, Mike thought all the white dudes was sorry. He was like, they work hard, but they just not talented. All of them.
All of them. Here's the thing. He respected John Paxson because he was like, look, the one guy that wants to be here, y'all doing them wrong. Y'all won't even give the guy a little bit of a raise. And he spoke affectionately about this guy. And he was saying, yeah, he work hard, but he ain't too talented. He ain't that good.
Right. And that actually is interesting in this. Even Paxson was trying to get his money and couldn't.
Well, he wound up getting it 30 years later through a lifetime scholarship.
Well, that's the thing. You never would have thought that 30 years later, John Paxson would have been the general manager, because in this book, John Paxson figures this is going to be his last year.
That's what I'm saying. This team was racked with doubt all across the board. B.J. Armstrong was like, I'll never be able to play my game. You know, coming out of Iowa, the type of player that he thought he was going to be. Scott Williams was an undrafted free agent, you know, crying at the end of a New Year's Eve game because he did not get in and he was just sitting on the sidelines. And during the blowout win, like, Cliff Livingston had, you know, his own issues.
Money problems.
Stacey King was certainly, remember the Stacey King, Horace Grant, the problems with their girlfriends and their wives, where that was amazing, like stuff that you hear about. For those uninitiated who haven't read it, Stacey King was drafted in 89, ostensibly to be the power forward of the future. Now, Horace Grant was drafted in 87, so it's a two-year difference, and then you got to think Charles Oakley was there in between, so he had just stepped into his role, and Stacey King's then wife would taunt Horace Grant's wife to say, Stacey King's going to basically take your husband's job, you know, and his money, essentially, and taunted her, verbally taunted her during a game for where they were sitting six rows apart, to which Phil Jackson had to call both of these dudes into a room and say, hey, get your wives to cool it. Like that type of internal conflict where either someone's pissed about their money or someone's pissed about their future. There seemed to be very little focus on actually the present and trying to win a championship, which they eventually wound up doing anyway.
Yeah. And keep in mind, and this is just like the small world of basketball, that for those who don't know, Horace Grant had a twin brother named Harvey. Like, the Grant that plays for Oklahoma City, that's Harvey's son, right?
Yes.
Those are Harvey's kids, not Horace's kids. But Harvey went to Oklahoma with Stacey King. And Harvey thought that Stacey was lazy. Right, which wound up being the rap on Stacey in the league. So Horace is walking in being like, told y'all this dude was lazy.
Imagine hearing the rap on that and then thinking, this is the guy that's going to take my job.
Yes.
I'm the hardworking Horace Grant, and this is the guy that y'all drafted to take my job. Like, imagine Horace Grant feeling like, oh, I can't do nothing right here. Like, these guys legit, and he just got paid. Like, there are some teams who pay players to try to ease their minds. Like, remember Eric Bledsoe in Milwaukee, where they basically paid him an extension so that he wouldn't turn into a pumpkin during the playoffs. And they're like, okay, let's mentally just get you in the right place and all this, so we don't have to worry about this in our pursuit of a championship. And then it wound up backfiring against him in the playoffs anyway, because although he played better, he didn't play up to expectations. Horace Grant was like, okay, wait, my brother's getting buckets in Washington. He's getting the numbers. I'm supposed to be the better brother. Remember that. Horace is supposed to be the better basketball player.
Yeah, Harvey was the other one. He was Ozzie Canseco.
Right. He's the other one. But Harvey's getting the numbers, and this is not in the day where, you know, we could quantify things beyond the raw box score numbers. This is where if you got 20 and 10, you were treated like 20 and 10.
Right.
So Harvey is that guy. Horace is like, I'm the third guy here. I'm never going to get a chance to really show what I can do. Plus, they're trying to get somebody to take my job. Oh, I got an interesting fact for you, Bomani. Guess who fought Harvey Grant and Horace Grant a week apart during the 90-91 season?
Huh. This is interesting. Fought them a week apart. And I feel like it's one of those, if you tell me the team, it'll give it away.
It wouldn't give it away. But I'll tell you the team.
Who?
Detroit.
Okay, so was it Sally? Was it Mahorn?
Mahorn wasn't there in 91, but no.
That's right. Mahorn was out there in 91. Was it Joe Dumars?
It was Joe Dumars.
Why?
During the Christmas Day game, which was on NBC, Grant had set like this hard screen on Joe, and Joe was really good at giving you a chicken wing. Mm. You know, because Joe was guarding you know, the Michael Jordans and all these other guys. So he had to worry about what was happening on his blind side. So he would give a guy a chicken wing every now and again. So on this one, Grant sets a back screen in the backcourt, and Joe gives him that chicken wing. Grant just tries to haul off and hit him in the ribs like an extended punch. And Dumars gets in this like stance where he leans back, and the refs just immediately jump in and stop play, and Horace Grant gets ejected. I don't remember the Harvey Grant physical one as much as I read about it. And I asked Joe about it, and he said to me, yeah, them Grant boys tried to get over on me.
You know what, though? I'm glad you mentioned that, because that ties into something that happened in the book club here. And this is something about the NBA, I imagine, is in practice, but it's also in games. There's basketball in general. Don't nothing start a fight like a screen, right? Like, screens and practice screens are extra tricky because we all on the same side, except in practice, we're not necessarily on the same side. And so it'd be tell from the documentary, Will Perdue doesn't really love Michael Jordan. Will Perdue set one of them screens on Mike. Mike hauled off and hit him and said, why don't you set screens like that in the game?
I mean, and think of Will Perdue, and I used to work with him when I lived in Chicago. Will Perdue is a large human being.
Yes.
Like, now all these dudes are big men, but Will Perdue is a large human being. Like, being a set a screen by someone who's probably more elbows and shoulders as opposed to like girth probably hits you a whole lot different when you are slender Michael Jordan running through screens at 215.
Yeah, and he wasn't even 215 by then. Well, I guess that this is when he started lifting the weights, right? So he did get in there. But no, because the story has always been there about Mike Punch and Will Perdue. But I read that and it was actually like, nah, this is just the kind of thing that happens in the NBA. A screen too hard in practice, that's going to start to fight.
Yes, there was an incident where I covered a particular team where one player from Duke and another player from Duke got into it over a screen, and the player that got screened too hard, and next thing you know, he got him with the 1-2. Subsequent Duke player did not fall, but he was knocked out.
O-W-T.
We were told that day, practice canceled.
Oh, was one of the players a rookie?
One of the players was a second-year player, if I remember correctly. One player was a vet. Yeah. One player was like a 10-year vet. Like, if Gabe wants to hit the music, I'll tell you the two players.
Thank you for your patience. A representative from the right time will be with you shortly. Your current hold time is
15 seconds.
Screens, man. Practice screens. Because, though, I may have told you about this. I went to these boxing matches, or at least what I did when we did that kind of stuff. The jab, wildly underrated. Like, people don't realize the pain that's coming with a jab. And the thing that people do not realize about basketball is the pain that is an NBA screen.
Don't look, you got to think, when they tell you, set the screen and don't move, that ain't necessarily just for, like, you know, fundamental purposes. That's to prevent a car crash from happening, man. That's, like, the closest thing to a football play is a moving screen where you got two guys moving in opposite directions at varying degrees of speed and nobody knows it. What was the segment on Countdown? Jacked Up?
Yeah.
That's Jacked Up. And you don't want to hit the franchise with a moving screen if you a 7-foot-1, 250-pound slab from Vanderbilt called Will Perdue.
Yeah, he hit Michael Jordan with the whoa! I just love the idea of Mike saying, why don't you set screens like that in the game? He's like, because I don't hate them, Mike. They don't be talking to me like you do.
Can you imagine how upset you have to be if you're Michael Jordan? Put it like this. Is Michael Jordan at 1991, does he have the most self-control of his image while he's playing during the game? And then all of a sudden during practice, he just loses it? Is he the guy that has so much control over his image while he's playing that he refuses to punch a guy for hitting him with a hard screen, but yet has so very little self-control during practice that a teammate who hits him with a hard screen winds up catching a 1-2 upside at the dome? Which one is it, Bo?
Yeah, but I feel like the second part is a different issue. You're not supposed to be hurting me. You're supposed to stop me from getting hurt. That's your job.
Don't hurt Mike Filter should be on all Madden.
Yes. Yes. Yes, I am saying that. I bet Jerry Reinsdorf think it should have been. Look, who was it? Ron Artest that broke Mike's ribs in the pickup game?
Yep, Ron Artest.
Now imagine that happening in practice. You think Ron Artest still on the team?
He's filing for a job at Circuit City the next day.
Yeah, yeah, he got to though, right? We got to send a message.
You got to go.
Yeah, this, it can't be this, right? Everybody needs to understand this is not allowed.
I mean, think about your Michael Jordan who practices hard. Like, I'm practicing hard. Remember, Michael Jordan's legendary for practicing hard, right? But he's saying, look, there's limits to this.
Yes. Yes, there are. Yes, there are.
You ain't setting no hard screens. There's certain stuff that you just ain't doing. Not because I'm the franchise, but because you're going to catch a 1-2 upside the dome. That's why.
Hey, man, got to be done. Got to be done. Now, another part I thought was interesting in a window into Mike was when James Worthy got busted for solicitation in Houston. By the way, James Worthy got busted for solicitation and played in the game that night, and the Lakers won. Yo, can you imagine in 2020 somebody getting busted for solicitation and then putting them right in the game that night? I feel like that wouldn't happen.
Well, I got a question for you. When the situation happened during the Super Bowl with Atlanta,
yeah,
did he play?
Oh yeah, I wish he hadn't.
But that was days
after. It was. He got busted like at midnight and then played. Like, you know, the next day. You know what I mean? Worthy got out of jail and came to the summit.
Well, I mean, he probably had at least a police escort.
Fair, right? Something to that.
And Jerry Buss does not seem like the type of gentleman. No, Jerry Buss does not seem like the type of gentleman that is not fully aware of all the trappings of Houston nightlife.
Yeah, nah.
So if Jerry Buss had to make a call and say, hey, guys, that guy in there with the goggles. Just do me a solid real quick, let him out.
Nah, I think Jerry Buss got caught in one of them glass houses things when that came around. Like, Worthy, like, I know you ain't about to say to me. I know it ain't about, to be you. Okay, that's what I thought. But what I thought was interesting about Mike was just so concerned with Worthy for his image. Mm-hmm. He was just like, once you lose your image with the public, you can't get it back, right? Like, I thought that said so much to me about the way that Mike looked at everything and the way that he's kind of looking at this documentary, like his concern that the way he treated Scott Burrell is going to make people dislike him. He really fears the idea of losing the public.
And think about it like this. In 1991, like, this is before Charles Barkley, I'm not a role model. I'm trying to get people to fully understand the currency that NBA players did not have in 1990 and 1991, right? Like, David Stern took over as commissioner in 1984. One of David Stern's things was like, look, I'm trying to get y'all paid. I'm trying to get the NBA to this place. We don't have the greatest of reputations in the public, whether it's real or imagined.
We can't win.
So you guys are going to have to basically build this reputation from the ground up as far as your public trust. And Michael Jordan, 6 years later, is thinking about it in this particular way, like with a level of clarity that I think we didn't know that Jordan necessarily had at this particular point, saying once you lose the public, you lose everything. To me, that says more about the ProServe, Nike stuff, the Wheaties boxes, all his endorsements and everything else. And James Worthy was not a big time celebrity at that particular point. Like, James Worthy was never a celebrity to Michael Jordan status, but Michael Jordan was aware enough to say, look, this thing is all you have. Like, it's almost like he valued that more than he valued, at least externally, like the athletic excellence.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, like, there are two windows. I think this book happens to be with Carolina alums. They give two windows into, like, kind of the human side of Mike to a degree. One is the Worthy thing and his concern of, you know, he was really concerned. Like, man, you know, you just messed up your image. The other is Scott Williams, you know, and I did not realize this about Scott Williams, that he was a highly touted recruit when he went to North Carolina. And then when his father killed his mother and then killed himself. And then Mike had always had this real, like, big brother type of concern for Scott Williams.
And that was something that we never saw because we didn't really see the humanity of it. And Michael was very, I want to say empathetic, but he didn't tell everybody how. Like the Make-A-Wish stuff or whatever that we wound up seeing with him later that, you know, left him in tears and saying like, look, how am I supposed to play a game after, you know, being with a sick kid once a week. Like, right. All these different things that he had to negotiate. And he never told everybody, hey, Scott Williams is upset because of this. After the particular game where, you know, the holidays were really hard for Scott because that's when it happened. And Scott Williams, I referenced it earlier, he was supposed to get in the game. He didn't. He was on the scorer's table. There was no stoppage and play time runs out. So Scott is basically just sitting at his locker in tears. And Michael does his interviews, you know, does his TV, does his print 20 minutes, which contributes to Mike being completely exhausted at the end of the 1993 season, almost at the end of this season. And it just says, hey, Scott, let's go get something to eat. And making sure that Scott Williams is not alone with all of this. Like, there is a certain respect that Michael has for the importance of parents, I think, that you wind up seeing later in his life that we don't necessarily see in other aspects. In some ways, you would say Michael Jordan was like a sociopath, right? Like, you would just think, like, competitively and everything else, like, he's single-minded and everything else, and he don't care what you're going through. But in that situation, it just gave you a window. And maybe that was Dean Smith telling him, hey, look out for Scott Williams.
Yeah, I do imagine that call at some point did come in.
I just found it really, I want to say, endearing, because I don't even think the bookmate might come off as bad as people that he may have thought it came, made him. I thought it actually just showed a human side, and it sort of stripped away the image and allowed him to be himself from that point on.
I think another part of this that I found to be interesting, and this tied into something that was a big deal in the first weekend of the doc, which is Scottie Pippen and Jimmy Sexton. Like, this quote about Jimmy Sexton: Sexton's firm represents about 50 professional athletes, but he said he never encountered real poverty until his first visit to Pippen's Arkansas home. Like, as people start putting into context what happened with him and that contract and everything else, it's not just that he's 1 of 12 and people are paralyzed, it's that they was dead ass poor before people were getting paralyzed.
So Pippen was definitely afraid of losing it all. I mean, think about it like this. Pippen went to Central Arkansas and he was 6'1". So we've seen this situation happen with Dennis Rodman. We've seen this situation happen with Giannis, where you get somewhere and you get 3 meals a day and all of a sudden, boom, you grow 6 inches, or your body just fills out. Like, I don't think that was necessarily puberty that Scottie Pippen.
That was poverty. That screams poverty.
Even though there's a level of grown man-ish stuff that Scottie Pippen has to own, you can understand why Scottie was so deathly afraid of losing everything. And almost you can see why Scottie Pippen was so almost afraid of the Pistons in a way. Like, they could really hurt me, and if they hurt me, I can lose it all. You know what? That migraine headache actually don't sound so bad. When you factor in all that stuff.
Yo, Mike still don't believe that migraine stuff. That's what I noticed in the documentary. Mike's like, look, man, I ain't in his head. I can't say how bad he was hurt. Like, Mike!
To this day! That's the sociopath.
This dude is telling you, I was seeing double. I'm on the bench with an ice pack behind my head.
And nothing helped. Think about it like this. With the benefit of hindsight, and Michael Jordan has watched Scottie Pippen played on a broken back in the 98 finals, right? In game 6, basically just to be a body and help Michael Jordan there. Like, they may not win that game without the little bit that Scottie gives them, right? And all these years later, Mike, knowing what he knows, not still like, I couldn't tell if he had a headache or not.
Well, hold on. Eddie played. It's not like he didn't play. He played.
Here's the other thing that people forget. In the closing game of the 89 conference finals, in game 6, Pippen catches an inadvertent elbow in the first minute from Bill Laimbeer. It was totally inadvertent elbow. Like, Bill Laimbeer would get forever blamed, but it was an inadvertent elbow and Scottie got knocked out and did not return. That was a scene where Joey Crawford was dragging Scottie off the floor because play was still going on and nobody would have even had any level of concern for the body on the floor. So the next year, Scottie catches the migraine headache and again is, you know, unreliable, undependable, unavailable, whatever you want to call it. So of course Mike is like frustrated, but like you said, at least Scottie was present.
But didn't he play like 38, like something like 40 minutes in that game?
He played 40 minutes, shot 1 of 10 from the field. I think we give Scottie too much credit for this migraine.
How?
Okay, not credit. There's people on your network who say the only reason the Bulls lost the game was because Scottie Pippen had a migraine headache.
I won't say that.
That's what I'm saying. They were down 23 points in the third quarter. As good as Scottie Pippen was, he wasn't making up no 23-point difference. So let's say he's available. They still lose by double digits because this is a game 7 on the road, and teams don't win game 7s on the road, especially at that point in NBA history. So while we can say, it's just, I won't say it's a convenient excuse, but, you know, as someone who's mocked Scottie Pippen a time or two.
A time or two.
Sitting Bull.
There you go. There you go. Scotty was going through something.
What happened to Sitting Bull? What was he going through then?
It was a lot. It was a lot.
Sitting Bull? I mean, what about the guy that hit the 17-point lead in L.A. in Game 7?
Well, I mean, we're not talking about the Pippen rules. We talk about the Jordan rules.
Once again, I told you, you cannot leave me an opening and not expect me to walk through it. You know what you came here for.
Man, you Detroit folks so hard on Scotty.
Absolutely. We respect Mike. That's the thing. Detroit people respect Mike for the journey that he had to go through. Like, there's an admittance, like, you know what? The Pistons really beat him down physically, mentally, not more mentally, I think, than physically. Like, all right, Mike, do you really want to go to the basket now? Okay, if you don't, then go out there and take that jumper. Cool. You can and admit that Michael Jordan's the greatest player ever. Scottie Pippen, little too much chip on his dip, man. Mm-mm. It's been like, nah, bro, you the sidekick. Stay the sidekick. You know what I'm saying?
Damn, man.
Stay the sidekick.
Y'all hard on that, man. Stay
in your lane, bro. That's all. Stay in your lane.
Dad, you so hard on that man. I tried to get a little sympathy for his situation with the poverty, and you're like, anyway, what about that time he ain't going to game?
But it started off as sympathy. It did. It started off as sympathy, and then it
did. And then you became yourself.
I'm sorry, Charlie Murphy. I was having too much fun.
Yeah. Let me tell you something else that came up, by the way, in this stretch that we read that I didn't realize. Like, I remembered when the Bulls had started putting their games on WGN, you know, because everybody had WGN all across the country, so watching Cubs games in the afternoon. But I had not thought about the other teams in the league being like, oh, hell no, man. Ain't nobody going to watch our own games.
And think about it like this. You got the number one attraction in the league at this point. The number one attraction in the league. Michael Jordan is selling out everything everywhere. Shoes, images, commercials, all this other type of stuff. And now you want to take away my ratings dollars? My advertising dollars? No. There was a point where the league had to push back against that.
Nobody cared about the Hawks when they did it. Nobody cared that the Hawks games was all.
Nobody cared about anything. And Dominique Wilkins was, you know, as far as like an attraction at that point, even by 1991, Dominique Wilkins was still a top attraction, but he wasn't Michael Jordan.
He ain't Mike.
Nothing's Mike. And there's a line where Jerry Reinsdorf, they ask Jerry Reinsdorf why he's more involved in baseball than basketball. And he says, David Stern doesn't let the owners get involved. And to me, that speaks to like the gangster that is David Stern.
Yes.
Circa 1991, telling billionaires, or maybe not billionaires back then, but telling millionaires, 100 millionaires, hey, this is my show.
Hold on. Keep in mind, Jerry Reinsdorf led a group 2 years later that ran the commissioner of baseball off his job.
I will say, and I guess maybe this is another sub conversation, but there was a lot of old guard owners. And Jerry Reinsdorf is an old guard owner now.
But he wasn't then.
I think he was more 5-6 years into it. So that's pretty much, you're still one of the new guys, you know, by that point. So David Stern was really, really good at making allies. So even though Jerry Reinsdorf had all this power in baseball and was going to shut the league down, they shut the league down.
With his team in the lead.
In the lead. Then think about it. Jerry Reinsdorf is the guy that says, I would trade all 6 of my NBA titles for 1 World Series. That's how important baseball was to him. But it wasn't as important as getting deals done on his terms.
That's right. And now it's funny because he and Mike are in the same room now.
You know, it's crazy. There's a point in there where Jerry wanted to pay Michael more, but couldn't, you know, just because of the, you know, collective bargaining.
So he was cutting a bit on the investment deals.
Until the league said, no, you can't do that. That is circumventing the salary cap. What do you think you're doing? But they were trying to find every single loophole there to keep that man happy. Why didn't they try that with Scotty?
Because he ain't Mike.
Yes.
Yo, because in the end, Krause is just kind of like, I mean, don't get me wrong, he's good, right? But Krause needs to feel like Scotty like you do.
He might feel worse. Because he's like, look, Scotty, I discovered you.
Yeah.
I brought you in here from Central Arkansas. Where else does Scottie Pippen become Scottie Pippen if not in Chicago?
It's a great question.
Not to say that Michael Jordan could not find a second guy, right? but I think it's a greater likelihood that Michael Jordan finds a second guy and develops and turns that second guy into a Scottie Pippen type, or into someone who can be as helpful as a Scottie Pippen, than it is that Scottie Pippen goes somewhere else and becomes Scottie Pippen.
Yeah, like I think Don Nelson is maybe the guy that could have gotten out of Scottie Pippen, because when Will produced it in the documentary that, you know, Scottie invented the point forward. No, Scottie's like 10 years late on that trend. Like Don Nelson came up with this as a concept. So maybe he'd have been the guy.
Yeah, but it's one thing to recognize that someone has the talent. I don't think anybody denied that Scottie Pippen had the talent. But that dog, that want to, there was one of Scottie's teammates who gave me this great quote about 5 or 6 years ago. And he said, Michael Jordan is so great, he went into the Hall of Fame as two players, himself and Scottie Pippen.
Wow. That's real, though.
You've said this before. There are two different types of people. A person who believes that Scottie Pippen is the most underrated player in the history of the NBA, or the type of person that believes Scottie Pippen is overrated.
Yep, that is basketball fans right there. You pick it one or you pick it the other. That's how it goes. You so mean to Scottie, though. I ain't never gonna be mean to Scottie like that. You so mean to Scottie.
That's the Detroit in me. I can't help it. I'm sorry.
I know. You try your best.
Look, I said Scottie played with a broken back in 98. What more do you want from me?
Yeah, I did one thing. What more could you possibly ask of me?
Okay, say something nice about John Starks.
Oh, I have no problem saying nice things about John Starks. John Starks was a dog. Like, I didn't root for the Rockets. I just point out that he's a legend in my city.
Say something nice around John Starks that does not revolve around 2 for 18.
It's amazing he was in the league that long. It is all because of want to. It's all want to. That dude wanted to be in the league, and he made it happen. I got no beef. I have no beef or no problem with John Starks as a basketball player.
Of course not. But the nicest thing you have to say about him is 2 for 18.
I mean, that made more people happy. Yo, man, you know what it's like to give a city what it dreamed of? Not everybody can do that.
Here's the other part. You thought John Starks was the guy in Biggie's story initially.
We all did. We all did. It just seemed like it.
Right? It just fit.
John Starks ain't never been more happy in his life to tell people he wasn't 6'5".
Man, I'm not 6'5". I'm like 6'3", 6'2".
One of them 6'5 dudes. That is one of the funniest, like, answers. And not that the dude in the story even had to be 6'5". Just what a great way to describe a basketball team. One of them 6'5 dudes.
Like, hey, I really ain't. When's the last time you heard a basketball player say, I'm not really 6'5"? I'm more 6". Like, Bomani, you 6'4", and I'm shorter than you.
Yeah, you don't have that.
Not anywhere. And look, there's players who are listed as 6'0". I'm not 6'0", but there's players who are listed as 6'0", and I can see the top of their head.
Yeah.
They would never admit to being anything shorter than 6'0". I am nowhere near 6'0". I'm like 5'10". So I'm like right at the, I'm not Jerry Krause. Like, yeah. I can't understand what it's like to be Jerry Krause, but I can understand what it's like to be not 6 feet tall. But if I was anything close to 6 feet tall, I'd be claiming it.
Yeah, you carry your 5'10 well, though. You and Pablo both. Is Pablo taller than you?
I don't think so. He's taller than I thought, but I don't know if he's taller than me.
He's taller than I thought. I see.
Is that all the code?
Nobody gets he's taller than I thought more than Pablo. And don't nobody want to be real, man. You know what I'm saying? Like, hey, you know, it's just, we all grew up in the same society. It don't make you a bad dude, but somehow everybody's made Pablo like 5'7". Like, I get it when people don't expect me to be as tall as I am, because I'm taller than the average bear. Pablo's coming in like right around the American average, and people are like, her.
No, I'll just give you a practical reason. He doesn't look tall on television. Like, the composition of his body doesn't look tall. Like, you're more legs.
Yes, that's
you know
fair.
What I'm saying? Like, yeah. some people are like, you got a long torso. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like,
but that's even with them doing him a favor, man. Cause one thing I hate about television is they always make you set the seats up so that everybody the same height, but we not the same height. Why are we acting like we the same height when we not the same height? I got to be out here making dreams come true.
Like this, bigger than people would think, taller than people would think, Stephen A. Smith.
Yes.
On both counts.
Yes. I think the taller part is interesting because most people know that he played college basketball, but he is on the list of taller. Dan Le Batard, taller than you would think.
Mm-hmm.
That is an imposing man. You don't want those problems.
Can we talk about, like, the dude who's, like, super emotional and then he fights.
That's what I said. I told Dan this the other day. You look like you cry when you fight, and I don't want no parts of that.
And he's probably got bricks for hands. I'm like shaking Dan's hands before, like, not to be like you measure a guy by the hands of stone, but Dan seems like he's got heavy hands, brother.
No, you don't want the problems, man. Like, I'm just telling you right now, Dan is not a man that you want those problems with. The industry got a few of those. Tony Kornheiser taller than you would think.
Yes, there was a picture of him, Wilbon, Adande,
I saw that,
and Aldridge yesterday, and Tony Kornheiser is taller than all of them.
Yep.
And they said even Tony Kornheiser with hair. He's got to be like 6'2", right?
Yeah, he's in that zone. Bob Ryan's another one, taller than you would think.
Really?
Yeah, Bob Ryan's in the 6-foot range.
Okay.
I don't want to do the dirty list, which is not as tall as you would think.
No, just give us one.
Am I really going to do that? Am I going to hit you with the not as tall as you would think? Actually, off the top of my head, I can't think of one. Whew. Saves me, because that has somebody showing up here trying to fight.
And your day is coming.
Yeah. Vinny Goodwill, Yahoo Sports, man. We appreciate you joining us here on the Right Time Book Club. Thank you, sir.
Hey, man, this is fun. And I'm sure Chicago will be very, very happy with my portrayal of their team, right?
Oh, yeah. They miss you.
Tell my mentions that.
And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this here a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you to Vinny Goodwill of Yahoo Sports for joining us on The Right Time Book Club. Next week, Joe Dumars of the Detroit Pistons will be joining us for that entry. We will be reading through Warming Up, it might say in your book, or it might say April/May 1991, or it might say page 276. Either way, that's where we are going with him. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us. Give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.